Well, good evening. It's good to be here with you again tonight. The nights keep rolling by. Here we are, Thursday night. I think we're about half done after tonight, if my calculations are right. Well, that's where worship begins, by seeing how big our God is and how small and insignificant we are. And our brother has led us in worship, and especially in getting a little better understanding of that. So thank you for that. All right, children, you're welcome to come up again tonight, and we'll have a little lesson here. Tonight we'd like to talk about counteracting overreaction. Counteracting overreaction. Inside your inner ear, there are three tubes that are filled with liquid. They're part of your vestibular system. And this system is what helps you to keep your balance. These three tubes are semicircular, and they're positioned differently to correspond with the different movements of your head. So if you turn your head from side to side, just doing that motion, there, that fluid in one of those tubes moves to correspond with that. If you put your head up and down, again, the fluid in another tube corresponds with that. Or if you go from like that or like that, the fluid moves in yet the third tube, which sends a message to your brain. It activates neural transmitters, and it sends a message to your brain telling your body where you are in relation to gravity, and you're able to keep your balance. I'm sure that you've all been dizzy, maybe after getting off a merry-go-round. Get off and you can't walk straight. Some people experience a condition called vertigo, which is a feeling that the environment you're in is constantly spinning. Balance is a wonderful gift. I remember learning to ride a bike. My first bike was a little yellow MX with a banana seat. But I learned how to ride it. We've all lost our balance, and we know the trauma and pain that that can bring. Physical balance can make a life and death difference, and tonight so can spiritual balance. I suppose a balanced definition of balance, it's got a few aspects to it, but one of them is a condition in which different elements are equal or in correct proportion, like the salt in the cookies. Cookies that have no salt don't taste that great, and cookies that have too much, you can't eat them either. Or time off work. We all need time off work, but if it gets out of balance, it's not good for the paycheck, is it? Another definition is even distribution of weight, keeping something in a steady position so that it doesn't fall. A balanced load. You know, those of you that drive truck know that you can't have too much weight out beyond the back axles, or you can't go very fast down the road. Another definition is harmony, a state in which nothing is out of proportion or unduly emphasized at the expense of the rest, like singing. If you don't have the parts in their proper sequence or at their proper volume, the soprano can dominate and drown out the bass, and it affects the quality of the music. Counteracting overreaction, and maybe the title is somewhat contradictory in itself, I don't know, but I know for myself, overreaction can be something that I need to deal with in life. When I overreact to something, I respond with more emotion or force than what is justified or needed. Up in Canada, when the COVID protest was going on, the government came down pretty hard on it, and the conservative government accused the liberal government of using a sledgehammer to crack a peanut. That's how they worded that. They felt that the liberal government was much too strong in its attempt to squash that. So how do you counteract? How do you curb? How do you prevent overreaction? How do we live balanced lives that produce balanced responses? And we'd like to look at that tonight. Luke chapter 9, verses 46 to 62. We want to take some principles here from these verses. Luke chapter 9, I'd like to start reading at verse 46 down to verse 62. Then there arose a reasoning among them, which of them should be the greatest? And Jesus, perceiving the thought of their heart, took a child and set him by him. And he said unto them, whosoever shall receive this child in my name, receiveth me. And whosoever shall receive me, receiveth him that sent me. For he that is least among you all, the same shall be great. And John answering said, Master, we saw one casting out devils in thy name, and we forbade him, because he followeth not with us. And Jesus said unto him, Forbid him not, for he that is not against us is for us. And it came to pass, when the time was come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem, and sent messengers before his face, and they went and entered into a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. And they did not receive him, because his face was as though he would go to Jerusalem. The Samaritans, they didn't worship in Jerusalem. They were worshipped on Mount Gerizim, is where they had their center of worship. And they did not receive him, because his face was as though he would go to Jerusalem. And when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, even as Elias did? But he turned and rebuked them and said, Ye know not what manner of spirit you are of. For the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And they went to another village. And it came to pass, as they went in the way, a certain man said unto him, Lord, I will follow thee whithersoever thou goest. And Jesus said unto him, Foxes have holes, and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. And he said unto another, Follow me. But he said, Lord, suffer me first to go and bury my father. Jesus said unto him, Let the dead bury their dead, but go thou and preach the kingdom of God. And another also said, Lord, I will follow thee, but let me first go bid them farewell which are at home at my house. And Jesus said unto him, No man having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. So a fair amount of reaction. Fair amount of reaction going on in this account here, and I'd like to learn from both the positive and negative responses here. We want to look at what creates overreaction, and then finally counteracting overreaction, and then the counterbalance. All of us like to think that we're pretty balanced in our thinking. We've got the equal and correct proportions all in place in our lives. We have it figured out. How to properly apply the principles of God's word, and we're pretty much in the middle, and you know, others are either to the right or to the left. Our applications are neither too liberal or conservative. We're perched pretty much perfectly on the center line. That's how we think. That's kind of our subconscious thought, isn't it? How can we be sure that we stay balanced in our thinking? Well, let's look at the cause of overreaction. What makes us use a sledgehammer to crack a peanut at times? What makes us respond with more emotion or force than what is justified or needed? Now, I'd like to draw an illustration of a teeter-totter, and I don't know. Do you have teeter-totters down here? You know what I mean when I talk about a teeter-totter? Is that what you call them here? A seesaw? All right. We'll call it a seesaw. We'll draw this seesaw here. We'll put the fulcrum here in the center. And we'll draw the seesaw like this. Little loop on the end to hang on. And we're going to put some points here that cause overreaction in our lives. Take a note of this account here. If we read the first part of the chapter here in Luke chapter 9, we'd see event after event that was amazing the world. The disciples were given authority. They were given authority over devils. They were given authority over diseases. You can read about that back in verse 1. They were preaching and teaching and healing everywhere. Verse 6 talks about that. And by verse 7, the politicians were starting to catch on that something was going on. Something grassroots was happening. Things were exploding. Verse 7 talks about Herod, and he heard of all that was done, and he was perplexed. Some were saying that John rose from the dead, and that was a big problem for Herod if that would have been true. This new movement was drawing crowds. One such event had 5,000 plus attendees. Jesus was there, and he just started dealing out fresh fish sandwiches to those that came. Then Jesus took his three disciples, later on in the chapter here, up into a mountain, and prophets from the past appeared, and these disciples saw them and their leader in glorious, dazzling, heavenly light. A cloud hovered over him, and it said, "This is my beloved Son, hear him." And then they come down from the mountain and they meet this distraught father with a demon-possessed child foaming at the mouth. Jesus rebukes the demon and he frees the captive. By verse 43, everyone's amazed at the mighty power of God. Life was on a roll here for these disciples. Big things were happening. They were part of something that was gaining a lot of fame and momentum. And suddenly, it's important to figure out who is the most important. Who is the most important? How do you figure that out? Who was the most important? Well, we all know the most important person there was Jesus, and he wasn't even worried about who was most important. You notice in verse 46, there arose a reasoning among them. They reasoned, they debated, they disputed. And it was all about who was the greatest. So our first point, the cause of overreaction is a competitive spirit. A competitive spirit causes overreaction. Competitive spirit. That should be a small S on there. That's what was going on here with these disciples. There was a competitive spirit. They reasoned, they debated, they disputed. When people compete, they try to win, they try to outdo others. Now, none of us like to play a game where there's no competition. If no one really cares and the game's just kind of lame because nobody's into it, that's not what we're talking about. That's no fun. However, I have played games. Up in Canada, we play hockey. Of course, I don't play too much anymore, but it can get pretty competitive. And when the competition becomes the overriding spirit of the game, it starts to get really dangerous really, really quick. People get hurt really fast. They start to shove and they start to slash, and way more force and emotion is used than what is needed. When it comes to kingdom work, we're not in a competition, are we? But sometimes we act like we are. And where the spirit of competition is present, it's contrary to the spirit of putting others first. And it's going to destroy trust and confidence. It always does. Church life, kingdom work is not a game. We honor, we prefer one another. Jesus said, "He that is greatest among you, let him be your minister or your servant." In all of our lives, both spiritual and social, brotherhood and business, yes, we must strive to focus on doing our best, but it's not about beating everybody else. That's not what it's about. You know, the spirit of competition, it can cloud our judgment. And it can cause us to respond in ways that are unbalanced. All right, another spirit that can cause overreaction is a controlling spirit. And we'll write that one down below here. A controlling spirit. And I was going to write, the fulcrum here, when this is going on, this all hinges on carnality. We'll put carnality here. It's selfishness. It's about us. You notice here in verse 49, it says, John tells Jesus here, we forbade him because he followed not with us. It looks like John has a very human side. The word forbade means to scold. It means to chastise. It's ordering someone forcefully to do something. And John, he goes over and he reams out this other, not sure what he was, a disciple, I guess. He was trying to help the cause. He was casting out devils in the name of Jesus. And why does he go over and do that to this other person? Well, it's because he was not part of their group. He admits that. What a reaction. What a revelation of what was going on in John's heart. Why would you go and scold someone for doing something good? I wonder what the poor man said to John. I mean, I can just kind of see him there with an open mouth. Here comes this disciple of Jesus, and he just thought he was helping the cause. Here comes this disciple of Jesus and just lays into him and takes a strip off of him. Jesus tells John, don't forbid him. If he's not working against us, he's working for us. Jesus wasn't too worried. He wasn't too concerned. I'm just amazed at the balanced emotions, the balanced response that Jesus has to this situation. But you know what a controlling spirit does? It manipulates, it maneuvers, it dominates, it dictates, it oppresses, and it overreaches. And this spirit, it can come into, I guess, any institution that is on the face of this earth. It can come into a marriage, and you can have role reversal going on. And when that happens, it spells problems. Relationship dies out, and there's a lot of toxic things happening. It can come into a church. It can come into a business, and it can wreck relationship. It can handcuff. It can hinder the work of God. A controlling spirit is often motivated by a fearful spirit. It's afraid that if it doesn't have say, the project's going to flop. If the project is successful, it at least wants a piece of the credit. And I think that was part of the problem here with John. He didn't want to share the credit in the limelight. Fear and pride always cloud our judgment and produce overreaction. A controller has a variety of techniques. How do I know this? Well, I'm very human. I've probably done it to others. I'm sure I have. And I've had it done to me, and that's how I know this. And you probably do too. But a controller has a variety of techniques. Sometimes exclusion is used. Make someone feel like they're kind of on the outside, so that they bow to the controller's lordship. Sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes it's flattery. Flattery. Have you ever been flattered or buttered up and found out and discovered that it was nothing more than an attempt to get you to do what the other person wanted? No, tonight I'm not talking about leading out and insisting on compliance and order where we are responsible for such. That's not what I'm talking about. But when authority or position, whether it's husband, wife, whether it's in the church, whether it's in business, when it's used for personal advantage, it's wrong and it's out of place. And it destroys the kingdom of Christ. All right. Number three, overreaction is also caused by or causes a combative spirit. Combative spirit. You can see that in verse 54. You'll notice These keep progressing. They kind of go from bad to worse. And that's usually how fights are. Wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? Now the big guns are coming out. The Samaritans, they didn't open the doors. What an insult. What a sanction. Can we drop a bomb on them, Jesus? That's literally what they're saying here. Please, just like your servant Elijah did, that ought to teach them. Talk about reaction. Talk about a response with more emotion or force than what was justified or needed. I suppose it would have eliminated the problem because it would have eliminated the people. Well, now it's Jesus' turn. Jesus' turn here to he doesn't overreact, but he does speak to the situation. He does rebuke. He says to his disciples, he says, "You don't understand what spirit is controlling you. I did not come to destroy people. I did not come to blow people up. I came to save and to heal and to help them." The overreaction issue only gets worse. It progresses from an inside caucus squabble to a controlling scolding of a perceived competitor to calling fire down from heaven to annihilate the resistance. And are we ever guilty of that? I hope not. Do we ever desire that or wish for that to happen to someone? And I think if we're honest with our hearts, sometimes we get awfully close to that, don't we? You know, there can be different methods. It can be the seeking of finding a weakness or an inconsistency in an effort to undermine an opponent. You see that happening in politics all the time. And many times this is done carefully, and it's done deliberately as if to not expose the true motive. It's often couched in concern or spun as a threat to innocent victims. The list goes on and on. You know, Abraham and Isaac are good examples of peacefully avoiding a fight and not overreacting. You know, there was disagreement between Abraham and Lot, and they settled it peacefully. When there was conflict with Isaac's hard-dug wells, it was settled peacefully. He simply went on and dug another well. Now, I'm not suggesting there's never a time to communicate and negotiate. Of course there is. But when it's beyond that, sometimes that's the only option that's left. Two men who lived in a small village got into a terrible dispute that they could not resolve. So they decided to talk to the town sage. The first man went to the sage's home and told his version of what had happened. When he finished, the sage said, "You're absolutely right." The next night, the second man called on the sage and told his side of the story. The sage responded, "You're absolutely right." Afterwards, the sage's wife scolded her husband. "These two men told you two different stories, and you told them they were absolutely right. That's impossible. They can't both be absolutely right." The sage turned to his wife and said, "You're absolutely right." You know, conflict is never resolved by focusing on who is right. Rather, the focus must be on what is right. And when that's the focus, I believe a resolution can usually be found. All right, the next point is somewhat of a paradox, but overreaction can cause a complacent, casual spirit. I'll just write complacent here. You say, "Well, how is being complacent an overreaction?" That's spelled right. Well, you look at from verse 57 down to verse 62, there's a lot of I don't know, a lot of excuses and a lot of complacency happening here. Verse 59 and verse 61 both use the phrase, let me go first. Let me go first. They're telling Jesus, let me go first. And the excuses of those who offered, or those who were invited to follow Jesus, it seems that they wanted the best of both worlds. They wanted the blessings of following Jesus, and they also wanted the comforts of this world. And their priorities were revealed in their responses. Jesus wants those who truly want to follow him and put him first. Those are who he wants to be his followers. Not that family, not that your farm aren't important. They are, but he wants to be most important. And he doesn't share first place with anything else. He doesn't. You know, we have seen many make the choice to be an informal follower, a let me go first Christian, a profession Christian, not a full-time cross-bearing Christian. There's many, many of those kinds of followers out there. Just in it for what I can get out of it. They want fast food Christianity, just kind of a whip through the drive-through, catch a sermon and a song, and they go on their merry way. And sometimes that's the reaction of an overreaction to maybe an imbalance that they perceive, maybe from a former, more orthodox setting that they were part of. It could be that. Or maybe it can be a reaction to a mistake or an offense that happened, and the people use that as an excuse to abandon the faith. Never a good excuse, never a reason. Always a reaction. Sometimes a young parent will overreact to a strict mom or dad and err on the passive side of disciplining their family. Maybe mom or dad was strict and they don't want that. So they react to the other side and they don't discipline hardly at all. And the consequences, the results are just as bad or worse. You know, the interesting fact is this evening that you will find that the dedicated, the committed, the real-time Jesus-first Christians are the most balanced people on earth. Because that's what living for him, that's what seeking to please him above everything else, that's what that produces. It produces balanced emotions. It produces balanced responses. All right, let's look now at counteracting overreaction. How do we check the overreactive tendencies in our lives? Jesus gives us some really simple clues, some really simple tips here, and we want to look at those now. we gotta change the focus here. We gotta change the fulcrum. We gotta change what's at the center. We're gonna have to change it from carnality to the cross. That's what we're gonna have to put here. And we're gonna have to make this seesaw level, because this is what will bring level, balanced responses here. And we're going to write them up top. And number one is going to be simply a childlike spirit. A childlike spirit. That's what Jesus says we need. Verse 47 and 48, after his cabinet, after his disciples, after those who followed him closest, after they got done reasoning among themselves who should be the greatest, Jesus finds a child and he sets him by him, it says. And I'm sure that little child was wondering what was going on. These quarreling, red-faced men were looking down, kind of mean-like at him. But he didn't run away. He stayed there, and he let Jesus use him as an object lesson. And he trusted Jesus, and he sat there until Sunday school was done for these disciples. Maybe it was the same lad that had shared his lunch with Jesus there when he fed the 5,000. Maybe it was the child that Jesus cast the devil out of earlier in the chapter. We don't know for sure. But the point is, a person that is balanced in their opinion of themselves, a person that has balanced emotions, a person that doesn't use a sledgehammer to crack a peanut, needs to have a childlike spirit. A trusting, depending on Jesus spirit that asks for wisdom and that asks, that desires, that invites, that allows His Holy Spirit to control their spirit. A forgiving spirit that lets the offenses of yesterday fade with the sunset and begins a new day unhindered by mistreatments of the past. An honest, open heart. You know, a child asks a lot of questions, and it's because they really want to know the truth. They're not trap questions. A childlike spirit is ready to confess and make their wrongs right. A child is content if their basic needs, when their basic needs are met. A child is accepting of others. You will find that. They are the most accepting people on the face of the earth. They take others at face value. A child is worry and carefree. And to be a balanced person, we need to have a childlike spirit. You know, one writer said, he said, the most important things are in life are not learned in college. They are learned in the sandbox. And I like this. They're learned in the sandbox. Parents, that's where you need to start, in the sandbox. Well, before they even get to the sandbox. But what's learned there? Share everything. Play fair. Don't hit people. Put things back where you found them. Clean up your mess. Don't take things that aren't yours. Say you're sorry when you hurt somebody. When you go out into the world, watch for traffic, hold hands, and stick together. Pretty simple. A childlike spirit. Now, these disciples, they were being childish, not childlike. And there is a difference. And it took many hard experiences and help of the Holy Spirit to get it the right way around in their lives. All right, number two, to counteract overreaction, we must possess a complementary spirit. A complementary spirit. Jesus said in verse 50, he said to his disciples, he said, forbid him not. Forbid him not. Don't go over there and ream out this perceived competitor because he's going to take your fire. He said, forbid him not. Let him go. And I think this evening, to be able to counteract an overreactive spirit, we must be able to compliment and commend others. Not in a way that flatters them, but in a genuine way. You know, we all like receiving compliments for jobs well done. And sometimes I hear my wife, she'll ask, we go somewhere for supper, for lunch, and she'll ask the cook there for the recipe. And I think if I was the cook and somebody asked me for the recipe, I think I would take that as a compliment. I'm not the cook, but that's how I would take that. You know, a young brother that has devotions, tell him, I was inspired by your devotions. Maybe it was the first time. Or to a young sister that's babysitting for you, tell her, good job with the babysitting. The children love when you come. Or to the neighbor that rose and that grew an exceptional crop, ask him, you know, what's your secret? What kind of seed did you use? Mark Twain said, I can live for 2 months on a good compliment. Well, why couldn't John go over to this other bishop, brother, or whoever he was here, and why couldn't he just say, hey, brother, keep it up. You're doing a good job. You're doing a good work. God bless you. You know, if Jesus commanded us to bless our enemies, surely we can bless those who are not against us, can't we? I think so. Don't get the idea that Dennis is of some kind of ecumenical persuasion, because I'm not. I don't promote just joining hands with every Christian professor that comes along. You know, Jesus didn't tell John to go put his arms around this fellow and invite him to join their ministry either. He didn't do that. But I can tell you there is no virtue in being critical of other people's work. I don't think there is. Do you think there is? The thought is this: can we be humble enough, Christ-like enough to see the good in others, or are we focused on finding fault? And I believe our focus is going to determine our actions and our reactions. All right, to curb and check overreaction, we need a Christ-like, compassionate spirit. Verse 56. Again, a very elementary point, but very important. Christ-like, I'll just write that there. Christ-like, compassionate spirit. Jesus says in verse 56, the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. That was Jesus' mission statement. That must be ours as well. Jesus has shown by his actions here on earth that compassion for mankind was his heart. That was his heart. To those who tormented him and crucified him, he said, Father, forgive them. To the woman that was guilty of adultery, he said, neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more. Because that was his heart. To the Samaritan woman at the well, he offered living water. To the sick and dying, he brought healing. To those who wept, he wept with them. To the disciple who wavered and started to sink in those waves, he reached out his hand and he helped him. He caught him. Even to the disciple who doubted, he didn't get critical and give him a long talking to, but he just reaffirmed himself. To the disciple who denied him, he gave another chance. For the whole world, he gave his life. And you don't see an ounce of overreaction. You don't see an ounce of self-centered action. You don't see any personal agenda in Jesus' example. Anywhere. I believe a Christ-like spirit of compassion for others will help us stay sweet and balanced in the offenses and in the reverses and in the successes that life brings. You know what? The successes can be the most difficult to navigate. And I believe it'll help us respond in a way that does not create further overreaction and division. All right, the counterbalance. The perfect balance of Jesus and his responses is beautiful. He was never hobbled or hindered because he overreacted to a situation in life. His compassion never smothered his passion for what was right. His humility never caused him not to stand up for the defenseless. So we want to look at, there is a counterbalance to this thing. We looked at the grace part, and we're going to look at the truth part a little bit here. You men here today understand what a counterweight is. It's used on things like lifts and cranes and excavators, and it's to help the machine when it's reaching out the front. The counterweight's on the back, and it helps to keep it balanced, helps to keep it from tipping over. Big Carl is the world's biggest crane. Big Carl can lift 3,000 tons, has a reach of 820 feet, takes 250 trucks to move. 52 counterweight containers weighing 100 ton each. That's Big Carl. He also needs counterweights. A sailboat has a ballast down below the hull to keep it from tipping over when the wind puts pressure on its mast 200 feet up in the air. And this evening we need a counterbalance as well to keep us from getting lopsided. And Jesus is a wonderful example of this. And I'd like to just put three counterbalances here on the other side. The first one is we need to crucify self and carry the cross. Carry the cross. And that means it's something we take us with us all the time. Carrying the cross is as important as carrying yourself. It's more important than carrying your cell phone around. I'm going to put it up top. Every Christian needs to carry their cross because you can't live without it. You leave it at home and, well, it's going to create a lot of problems, the least of which is probably overreaction. Jesus always controlled his spirit, his emotions, his attitudes because he had one goal in life, and that goal was to do the will of his Father. To do the will of his Father, not his own will. And that's where the cross comes in. It comes in where our wills intersect. And that's where you need it. You need it daily. You need it all the time. If you look at verse 22 and verse 44, Jesus continually reminds his disciples. He says, don't fly too high. Your ideas, your dreams, they are not going to turn out the way you think. That's what he's telling them. Because you're not going to be vice president. You're not going to be minister of finance or minister of defense in an earthly government. And that's what they were thinking. That's why they were still in this earthly mindset, that they got to figure out who's the greatest so they could figure out how it all stacks up. Jesus said, that's not what this is about. Verse 23, Jesus says, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily. And so many times we as people are overreactive because our plans and our dreams and our goals are getting stepped on or they're getting squeezed. Something is getting in the way of where we want to go. Maybe someone doesn't give us the recognition we think we deserve and we get offended. Or maybe something or someone gets in our way and way of our agenda and we get angry. Or maybe a rumor ruins our self-made image and we can't go where we want it to go. Or our advice or input isn't accepted and we get kind of bitter about that. Or our expectations are not met. We become cynical. You know, where there's anger and frustration, bitter and cynicism, it's going to cause overreaction. I'd like to just talk a little bit here about cynicism. You know what cynicism is? It's doubtful, it's distrustful, it's suspicious, disbelieving, negative, disillusioned, disenchanted. And I find a tendency in my own heart, I can very quickly become cynical when I feel someone lets me down or something doesn't turn out like I thought or I don't get what I wanted. I can get cynical. And that's a track we don't want to go down because it's going to take us to a place we don't want to be. It's going to take us to a place of reaction. It's going to take us to a place of disconnection. It's going to take us to a place where we're alone. And that's a very vulnerable place to be. Don't get cynical. Jesus had to constantly crucify his will to do his Father's will. And the recipe is no different for us. The second thing is, second counterweight is confront and correct carefully. There is a place for confrontation. There is a place for correction. Confront and correct. Carefully, patiently. Notice the amount of times Jesus needed to confront his disciples in these verses. It reminds me of the big puppy that was around our place for a while. He was constantly needing confronting and correcting. And oh, he would chase the colt, he would chase the cows, he would chase the geese, and then he'd be over at the neighbors chasing the sheep. And He loved the taste of the ATV seat, and he was such a friendly, happy, curly-tailed dog. He's the kind of dog he just melted your heart. But you know what? Without correcting him and confronting his actions, he was a miserable dog to have around. And, you know, to not confront and correct him would have ruined him. And to correct him too harshly and impatiently would have ruined him also. And how we need God's wisdom. And we need the cross. We just don't have it in ourselves, do we? But we need to get the balance right. And with God's help, we can. We're part of a community of believers. That's what the local church is. And it's inevitable that situations will come where correction is needed. But we need to take it, and we need to give it. And I would say this, always give it the way you like to get it. Not too hard to figure out. All right, number three, last counterweight is simply contend earnestly. There needs to be passion. You've got to have your heart in the game. Contend earnestly. Like I said before, no one likes to play where people's hearts aren't in it. You know, these three applicants here in these verses from 57 to 62, they never got any further than putting their resumes in. That's all the further they got. They were quitters before they even started. They wanted the paycheck without the sweat. They wanted the benefits without the sacrifice. They had the secondary and the primary position. And their lack of action, or their reaction to Jesus' call, was perhaps the overreaction that they put him first. You know, the things we're passionate about are what we put our shoulders to. The disciples here were passionate, but not about the right things. It was about their agenda. At the bottom of it all, they were passionate because it benefited them. And that's what caused their reactive responses when they felt that those benefits were going to be threatened. You know, we'll follow you, Jesus, but first we need to get the mortgage paid off, or first we need to take care of our social obligations. This evening, we're in a fight, and we're in a good fight. It's a fight for the future of our eternal souls and our fellow man's. We're in this together. Let's keep our eye on the mark. Let's keep our eye on the enemy and not start contending with each other. We're in a race, and it's a race that takes everything we've got. Let's not get sidetracked. Let's not use our energy on useless detours or selfish motivations. In our contending, let's not become contentious. We're not in a competition with the other runners. We don't need to control who's in the lead. This evening, you can put a smile on your face, keep your feet on the ground, keep your eye on the goal. Jude chapter 3 tells us to earnestly contend for the faith. I'd like to close with a little story here. At the 1983 Australian Ultramarathon, a foot race of 544 grueling miles from Sydney to Melbourne, an odd competitor showed up. Everyone else was highly trained, commercially sponsored professionals, but Cliff Young was a 61-year-old farmer. Unlike the others who were clad in professional running shoes and cool athletic gear with sponsored logos, Cliff wore a loose white shirt flopping over his baggy overalls. He had rubber goulashes over his boots and a white baseball cap hung with sunscreening flaps. The officials laughed, thinking they were being set up for a joke. But Cliff was serious. He was ready to run. His name went down on the roster, and someone pinned a number on his faded overalls. Uncertainty about Cliff continued as the runners lined up to start the race. Was this old man going to compete against young, highly trained athletes with sculpted bodies? Some still thought it was a joke. Others thought he was naive and perhaps a little deranged. Some cheered and shouted insults. When the starting gun fired, the runners took off. The crowd laughed at the contrast between the young contestants' disciplined strides and Cliff's odd-gated shuffle. But 5 days, 15 hours and 4 minutes later, no one was laughing. Cliff Young crossed the Melbourne finish line almost 10 hours ahead of the second-place runner. The astounded press descended on him en masse. How did this aging farmer accomplish such a spectacular run? Two facts emerged. First, as a shepherd, too poor to own a horse, Cliff often herded entire flocks of sheep alone, sometimes running day and night to keep up with the flock. Second, he didn't realize that runners in ultramarathons stopped at night to rest. He ran the entire distance without sleeping. Well, I guess the first shall be last, and the last shall be first, but Cliff contended earnestly. He pressed forward, crucifying those aches and pains and the urge to sleep. And he was motivated by one goal, and that was to cross the finish line. And I believe tonight, if that is your goal, if that is the goal of each one of your brothers and sisters, it's going to help a lot when it comes to overreaction with each other.